From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Kirthana Ramasetti is my guest. She is a novelist and a former entertainment reporter, and her new novel, her second, is called Advika and the Hollywood Wives. It's a really entertaining book, and it's a pleasure to say, Kirthana Ramasetti, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I love your book. Thank you for sending it to me. In your book, your heroine is really delighted when Slumdog Millionaire wins the Oscar, because yes. You know, she's from India, and the story and the characters in that film are from India. So was that kind of one of the driving forces in your, because you've written two novels and they both seem to have heroines that are of Indian heritage. And is that one of the things that you've set out to do as a writer?
Yeah, for me, I've always had a lifelong love of reading and books. And I always like to say, especially when I was growing up, I loved books so much, but I didn't always feel that they loved me back, in the sense that I didn't always feel represented or seen in the stories that I loved. So, and excuse me, I live in New York City, so you might hear a siren. I apologize.
Wait a minute. If you live in New York City, we'll definitely hear a siren.
Exactly. So once I decided like I'm going to write novels and give this like a good old fashioned try and see if I can actually get published, it's always been important to me to have the protagonist in a novel that I always wanted to read myself when I was growing up. Representation is something that's really important to me. And so both my novels, and I think going forward, all my novels will always have an Indian American woman as a protagonist. And no matter what the story is about, that will always be what is important to me, because I want other readers to feel seen in the way I hope to feel seen when I was reading novels and, you know, trying to figure out who I was in the world.
Do you have a lot of stories that are rattling around in your head? Do you see yourself writing 20 novels or 60 novels or?
60, wow. I would hope so. The other day I had the privilege of meeting a novelist who's written 24 books, and that astounded me. And I would only hope to be able to do so. I do have a lot of ideas.
Yeah.
I hope maybe hopefully reach 20, but I'd be happy to reach 10. We'll see.
Well, two down.
Or two down. Yeah.
Yeah. And both have been very well received, I know. And this book, draws on your background as an entertainment reporter, certainly. In fact, you know a lot about movies. In fact, there's kind of elements of Gaslight in this book, but it's like you know more about movies than your character knows.
I would say so. I'm definitely older than my protagonist. She's 26 when the novel begins, and I'm in my 40s, and I feel like because I've always had such an interest in pop culture, even before I started working in entertainment journalism, I've always tried to have a well-rounded interest in pop culture. So not just the movies that I grew up with, but I always wanted to learn more about what's happened that preceded me. So like a movie like Gaslight, I know what that movie is. And like the black and white movies from the 20s, 30s, etc. I really want to make sure that even though my character, Advika, loves movies, specifically romantic comedies, but for me, I think I have just an overwhelming love for all things pop culture. And it's really informed me as a writer and a person.
It took me a couple of chapters to realize that all of the chapters of your book are romantic comedy movies, or rom-coms, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's right.
did you have were you trying to balance how much of your book would be a thriller and how much of it would be a drama?
You know, the thriller element actually surprised me, because it's something that kind of emerged organically in just the writing of the novel. And I'm going to apologize again. There's some weird construction settling happening downstairs. So apologies if there's some, it's New York City. There's always
we like the touch of New York here. It's very nice. did you run down and get an egg on a roll for us? Or?
That is the beauty of New York City, too, I should say.
Yeah.
And now I lost my train of thought. Well, did you repeat?
We're talking about your new book, Advika, yes. And the Hollywood Wives, Kirthana Ramasetti. And you were talking about how the thriller aspects of this novel kind of emerged on their own.
Yes. So once I came up with the idea of a woman who marries a man who's much older than her, and decides that she doesn't really know who she married and needs to investigate him through the lives of his ex-wives. It started the way that Avnika was uncovering information about him, going online and doing research, watching the ex-wives' movies or listening to their music. It started playing out sort of as a thriller, because every time she finds out something new about an ex-wife, it kind of informed her current relationship with her husband, Julian. And it starts picking up the pace of a thriller. So once I realized I was writing a thriller, that was very intimidating. I've never really written anything like that, but it was also exciting, really exciting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it kind of dawns on the reader. I think I don't want to give too much away of your book, but, you know, I looked at the cover of your book and I didn't think I was reading a thriller. And then I was, which I really enjoyed. But I want to ask you about your time as an entertainment reporter, because I know this must have played a role in forming this book. How did you you went to school in Boston, and then you got into being an entertainment reporter?
Yes. So I think what happened, I'm originally from Southern California, and I attended UCLA. So again, a lot of the California is already steeped in me from growing up there.
Well, let me interrupt for 1 second then. Kirthana, where did you go to high school?
University High School in Irvine.
Uni? Uh-huh. Yeah, sure.
Uni High. Our most famous alumni is Will Ferrell. That's like the random facts that I always have in my brain.
We love him. Yeah, I grew up in Southern California as well. So, okay. And you went to UCLA. Go on. I'm sorry. I didn't interrupt.
No problem. And so I decided to get my master's in my MFA in creative writing at Emerson College in Boston. But, you know, just because I received a degree in creative writing, there's no real career path for an MFA unless you become a teacher. So I thought I would take what I have most knowledgeable about and interested in, which is journalism, specifically entertainment, move to New York City, worked at various editorial and freelance positions before I worked for a time at Newsday and the New York Daily News as an entertainment reporter. So it was really interesting for me once I decided to, like, I have this MFA degree, let me try to actually use it and write a novel, is that I was able to take all what I learned as an entertainment reporter and the whole experience of what it was like to report on celebrities and pop culture and kind of steep those things into my work.
When I got my MFA, one of my friends said, what are you going to do with your MFA? And I said, well, I'm going to get a little frame for it.
Yes.
So when you were an entertainment reporter, did you, you know, being a movie fan, was it fun? Did you get to meet people that you admired?
You know, most of the time I was an online reporter, so it was a lot of time spent in the newsroom. But on occasion, I would go to premieres or interview people in person, and that was always a lot of fun. There was always like pinch me moments within that. But I also did a lot of phone interviews too, that I got to talk to people whose work I enjoyed so much in television and film. So I remember like a highlight for me was speaking to Elizabeth Moss from Mad Men, and I'm such a fan. And so it was a dream to talk to her. So those kind of experiences are great, but I wouldn't say they made up most of my time. Most, it's probably like 30 to 40%. But most of the time I was just reporting on, like, you know, the box office reports or what, a certain celebrity marriage or divorce, that kind of thing, whatever the breaking news was at any given moment.
Yeah. I think it would be fun. And as I should mention that our friend Jennifer Cation Armstrong, who introduced me to you and to your book, was an entertainment reporter too before she became an author. She worked for Entertainment Weekly. So I guess it kind of runs in your crowd.
Yes,
do you still have a lot of friends that are entertainment reporters?
A few, and Jennifer is one of them. But it's interesting how we've all sort of kind of transitioned. The media landscape has changed so much since I was working in entertainment journalism, which is one of the reasons I decided to actually start trying to write a novel, because I felt like it was becoming, the landscape was changing so much and was becoming so unstable. I felt like I had to find a different route to explore for my career. And in the meantime, while I was trying to figure that out, let me try to write a novel and see if I had it in me. So it kind of, that's how that ended up.
Well, I would think that if you become a novelist and you have a background in entertainment, naturally you're thinking maybe somebody will option one of my novels and make a mini series with Elizabeth Moss in it, or something. But maybe this particular novel, it might alienate some of the Hollywood types because it's kind of maybe not flattering to Hollywood people.
You know, that wasn't really consideration when I wrote it. First of all, you never dream. When you're in the process of writing a novel, you don't even know if anyone will ever read it. So, like, dreaming of an option one day is just, like, you're really dreaming at that point. But in terms of, I hope what it comes across as, and what I've heard feedback from some people who do work in Hollywood, is that it's realistic, which is all I can hope for. I really wanted to present... what was so interesting about writing this novel is I have to choose when to set the novel. Should I quickly mention what it's about to provide context?
Yeah, go ahead. I mean, tell us what you think we need to know going in.
So my character, her name is Avrika. She's an Indian American, aspiring screenwriter who is mourning the death of her twin sister. And so to pay the bills, she works at a lot of A-list events as a bartender, including the Governor's Ball, which is the official after party of the Oscars. While there, she meets Julian Zeldin, who is a 5-time winning Oscar film producer. He's won 5 Oscars for producing, and he's won an Oscar on the night that they've met. They also have a 40-year age difference. Avrika is in her late 20s, Julian is in his 60s. But despite that, they hit it off. They have a whirlwind romance, courtship, and get married in 3 months. And so for Avrika, she feels like she's finally trying to get closer to her lifelong dream of working in an industry she's always felt that she was an outsider in. But the marriage doesn't quite feel completely right. And then that intuition is paid off when a news story breaks that Julian's first ex-wife has passed away. And in her will, she has bequeathed $1 million to Avrika if she divorces Julian. So Avrika realizes, oh, did I marry? I don't know him at all. And then decides to figure out who her husband is through the eyes and experiences of his ex-wives, all of whom were famous in different ways. And so when deciding when to write this novel, about when to set it, because, you know, for any novelist right now, the one thing you're always wondering is, should I set it before the pandemic or after the pandemic? And it really, there's a lot of consideration about when to set a novel, because so much can impact your storytelling based on what time or date you choose. And I specifically chose 2015 for 2 reasons. One, it was the year of the Oscar So White viral campaign, in which there was an outcry about diversity. And that year's nominees were, you know, they weren't diverse, noticeably so, and which sparked the viral campaign and the hashtag and the movement to do better in terms of having diversity and representation, not just at the Oscars, but in Hollywood in general. So my character, Avrika, is working as a bartender, surrounded by the people who she aspires to be among, not as a bartender, but like one of their peers. So to have that campaign happen gives her hope that maybe there's a place for her in the industry. So that hope and optimism is kind of what buoys her when she meets Julian Zeldin and he takes interest in her romantically. She's open to it because she just feels so open that she feels like maybe Hollywood is finally opening up to her overall after years of struggle and a lack of recognition. And then the other reason I chose 2015 is that preceded the Me Too movement, which I felt was very important because Avrika starts having some realizations about her husband and his relationship with his ex-wives and how much of an impact he had on them professionally and personally. But because there's no dialogue yet about how to speak out about the power imbalances and how they impact women, the Harvey Weinstein news has not yet emerged. She doesn't quite know how to talk about this. There's no public dialogue for it. So she has to kind of figure out her own way of dealing with what she finds out and find a path forward and kind of forge forward in a way where she's not going to have a lot of help from a lot of people because there's just no way to have a conversation about it at that time. So we're not talking about it back then. So hopefully those 2 things will kind of impact the way I chose to depict Hollywood and what happens both, you know, in the news, but also a lot of the times behind the scenes as well.
I think also there's a strong element in addition to the Me Too movement thing, which is definitely a feeling in the story. There's a strong element of dealing with the sort of the PTSD of dealing with loss. Mm-hmm. And that's that's one of the things that propels her into her marriage, would you say?
Oh, 100%. This is, one of the things that really impacts my writing is the fact that family and relationships are really important to my characters. You know, family is one of the most important things to people of who are South Asian, especially those living in this country. And for my character, Advika, to lose her twin sister, sends her spiraling in 100 different ways because it kind of fractures not just her family dynamic. She becomes estranged from her parents, but also her closest friends who she's grown up with and known her entire life. For the first time in her life, she feels completely alone and isolated. And so when this man, who's not just handsome and charismatic, but powerful and can open doors for her in the industry, she makes the wild decision, the impulsive decision to go for it, because in a way she's like, what else do I have to lose? I've lost the thing that's most important to me.
We're talking with Kirthana Ramasethi, and her new book is called Advika and the Hollywood Wives. And I hope I said everything correctly. I want to talk a little bit about you brought up several things that I want to ask you about. You were saying how, you know, what do you do with the pandemic when you're writing fiction? But on the other hand, couldn't you, I mean, in your world, or in Advika's world, there is, in fact, a Slumdog Millionaire, but there's no Birdman, apparently, because Julian did not produce that movie. So whichever movie won, so if you can have a world where it can go however you want, then there doesn't even have to be a pandemic.
Yes, that's true. But I do feel like I wanted to have somewhat, we have references to the real world and realism. So people who are reading the novel can kind of have a, when they're reading it, it doesn't just feel like a complete, maybe alternate reality, but they can kind of relate to what was happening in the world at a given time. The interesting thing about living in the day and age we live in is that 2015 wasn't that long ago, but so much has transpired since then, like so much in so many different ways. So I feel like for a lot of people, it's also an interesting benchmark where I feel like 2015 was the last year just to kind of feel like my foot felt normal in a lot of ways.
It was the golden age.
Maybe the golden age. And so I think that was interesting to depict as well. Like as you read the novel, you know what's coming in the years to come also.
Yeah, right.
In terms of 2016 courts, which I thought was also an interesting thing to do.
Advika must think that Hillary Clinton is going to be the next president. Because we all did. There's also a thing that's happening in your book that we mentioned that all the chapters have rom-com titles and that she's a fan of rom-coms, but your book really kind of turns a rom-com on its head in the way that, I was thinking of the movie The Graduate, in the very end of The Graduate, when Benjamin and Elaine have run off together and they get on the bus and they go off and like, oh, happily ever after. Only Mike Nichols leaves it a couple of seconds longer so that you can see that they're looking at each other with what the hell do we do now? How did we get here? So that's kind of what you're doing where you know, it could be this happily ever after thing, but that isn't what happens.
One of the things that was interesting for me to write is this book, knowing that the first, I mean, it's a bit of a spoiler alert, but I think it's okay. But the first maybe third of the novel, you do feel like you're reading a romantic comedy. And I feel like I had to thread the needle where you understood why Advika would get swept up in this romance with Julian. And you see that the pairing, you know, works in a lot of ways. They do have a lot in common, but at the same time, the intuition that something is not quite right in this relationship is also there. And in the novel, I have the voice of Advika's late twin sister kind of ringing in her head, kind of saying, this doesn't quite feel right. And what is this? This feels like a red flag. So try to thread a needle where the romance feels genuine. You understand why she would pursue it, but also feel like there's more here than a traditional rom-com that's happening.
You also do a wonderful thing in your book, Advika and the Hollywood Wives, which is to comment about women's friendships with women and not just with women, but with men as well, I guess, because some of her close friends are men. But she learns some things about friendship, and I find that really interesting. And I wonder where that came from exactly.
One of the things I really wanted to do with this novel was actually have friendship be a major component of it. My debut novel was a family saga, and I tried writing two novels before that I shelved, and those were also family sagas. So by the time I got to Adelika, I'm like, I don't want to write a family saga anymore. But I do want to write about something that's also very important to me, which is friendship. And I wanted to write about two different kinds of friendship. One is the kind of, that is very close to my heart, is the notion of family friends. You know, growing up in this country, most of my relatives are in India. So I grew up around with other Indian families, and those kids became basically like my cousins. We grew up together. We've known each other so well. There's a lifelong bond of loyalty and friendship that I feel like cannot be replicated elsewhere because we just know each other and our lives so well. So it's, the depth of that bond has always been something very important to me. And I wanted to pay tribute to that in this novel by having Advika's family friends be a community for her and a huge support for her when she realizes she doesn't know what to do about this marriage she finds herself in. But then I also want to pay tribute to the fact that sometimes we can find friendships that are significant and important to us later in life. Because so many of us form our friendships, you know, in childhood, high school, college, and when you become an adult, it can be a little harder to make friends. But I wanted to show that we can still make really impactful, significant friendships as we got older. And so that's what I show with the friendship between Advika and her roommate, Olive. They have a very interesting kind of prickly relationship, but it develops into a very sweet friendship that was just so much fun to write.
Yeah, it's a wonderful aspect of your book. You know, throughout the history of Hollywood, there has been this double standard of once a woman is, 28, that's the end of her movie career. You know, you don't see Michelle Pfeiffer very often anymore, or even Julia Roberts, I guess. But, you know, no matter how old, Clint Eastwood was like 208 and he's still appearing in movies. And, you know, throughout the history of movies, we would watch Fred Astaire. First, he's dancing with Ginger Rogers, who's age appropriate, and then he's dancing with Leslie Caron, who's like 9 and he's 70. So you kind of address that a little bit in the story too, because of this age difference between Advika and Julian.
That definitely was on my mind for sure, because I remember when the news during the Me Too movement and the news, what we learned about Harvey Weinstein and the actresses who had been impacted by him, I remember thinking there were so many actresses I grew up with watching their movies in the 90s specifically, and they just seemed to disappear after a while. And you stopped seeing them in these marquee roles, but their male counterparts continued to work and be movie stars. And I actually got mad at myself for never really thinking about why did they disappear? Why was it just assumed that they would be faded away after a while and get replaced by newer actresses where we don't have that expectation for actors? So that was heavily on my mind when developing the character of Julian's first ex-wife, Evie. And why despite a promising career where she's nominated for an Oscar, her filmography is very brief. It's only 5 movies, and then she moves to Europe. And the notion of how easily actresses' careers can be diminished and have their, you know, their lives impacted by the people who are in power and have little recourse, but to try to just either stay the course and try to push on in a system that does not support them or just take themselves out of it was something that was heavily on my mind while I wrote this book.
I had an opportunity to interview Tippi Hedren, the actress, here on this show, and she told me that her career was completely destroyed by Alfred Hitchcock, who refused to let her work unless she would have sex with him. Yeah, the classic sexual harassment.
And this is just a thing that's been ongoing in Hollywood for so long that we just never really, it was never really openly discussed. Maybe it was understood by some people in the industry, but now I feel like we're in a place where we understand now. I mean, even right now, we're seeing what happened with Britney Spears right now. This is an ongoing conversation. Where for so long, we just thought, oh, she's troubled. Oh, you know, I hate the word crazy, and they would use the word crazy. But now you know the forces that were built up against her to exploit her and use her. And that is so common and across Hollywood and other entertainment industries. So I'm glad there's a reckoning, but it's been happening since the beginning of Hollywood. It's been happening now. So I'm glad at least there's a conversation happening.
Your book also takes a lovely kind of turn to the 1970s music industry, which I really love that part of the book. And I wonder what kind of research you did there. Who were you thinking of, if anybody?
You know, it's interesting, and it's a bit of a spoiler alert to say this, but I think it's okay. But I was thinking about actually my reaction, and I think my reaction wasn't alone, when I found out that Freddie Mercury, who I loved Queen, I loved Freddie Mercury, and then one day, maybe I was in junior high or high school, I found out that he was of Parsi Indian descent. And that blew my mind, because I'm like, one of the biggest rock stars of the industry has a similar heritage to mine, and I didn't know it. And my first thought was pride. Wow, someone of that talent and that stature, you know, was born and raised in India. That's amazing. But then after a while, I also thought, well, that's also kind of too bad. Like, why am I just finding this out now after the fact? What would that have meant if he had been able to discuss this openly? I don't think he ever tried to hide it, but I don't think he ever talked about it either. And so I know it would have been a game changer in a lot of ways if he had been comfortable being more open in talking about where he came from and his heritage, but I'm not sure he did. And so that kind of history informed my shaping of the second ex-wife, whose name is Nova Martin. She's a singer-songwriter in the vein of Carole King, Joni Mitchell, but she's also coming of age in an industry that's shifting from the singer-songwriter heyday of the 70s to MTV of the 80s. And what is being asked of artists, especially women in the 80s, is be much more focused on image and presentation versus authenticity. So I did, so all this stuff I kind of inherently know, just as being a person who's such a fan of pop culture, but I definitely did some research about the industry in the 70s and 80s and the shift that was happening in those two times.
Well, you remind me of the story of Merle Oberon, who was also an Asian actress, Academy Award nominee, who kept her Asianness a complete secret throughout her entire life, pretty much.
100%. She was another inspiration for that concept of who my character turned out to be.
Yeah. But also this thing that happens in the music industry where a person comes in with a certain kind of genuine feeling and talent, and then the industry descends upon her and creates something that she's not comfortable with.
Yeah, and how do you figure out what you're comfortable with? Not everyone gets to be the person they want to be when they have an artistic vision for themselves. And how much of that do you compromise, and how much do you sacrifice in order to kind of make it as a star and succeed in the industry? And that's what all three of these ex-wives of Julian have to deal with. Because all the ex-wives of Julian and Advika herself as a fourth wife come in, have so much ambition and for such specific industries. One is movies, one is music, one is reality television, and of course Advika wants to be a screenwriter. But what happens is there's a lot of compromises that have to be made. And largely those compromises are because the people in power want to put people in boxes about how they think you'll be most successful, or how they see you versus how you see themselves. And I feel like this is, of course, an ongoing thing that's happening to this day. So it's a really interesting thing to explore.
Kirthana Ramasetti, one of the things that I was struck by in your book that you do really, really well, and I don't know how you do it, and I wonder, it's probably because you've written three other novels before this, two unpublished and one published. But the way you layer in, you start, you know, it's like we're started and we're going and we're in our story. And then you start to layer in all this information, and you really do it skillfully. Is there a technique you use? Do you have like index cards or little ribbons across the room or something? How do you manage that?
Well, thank you. That's a huge compliment. And I really, really appreciate that. Because I feel like some people are very index card heavy, and I'm not that person. But what I do try to do is make my writing as easy for myself as possible. And in the case of this novel, Because it takes place, a lot of this novel takes place during different time periods. And so what I had to do to maybe keep everything straight for myself is I created chronologies for each of my main characters. So I knew exactly, you know, every character, every single important milestone in their life from birth until death and everything in between. Because there's a lot of overlap, let's say, between Afika's life and Victoria's life. That's the third ex-wife of Julian. So in order to keep all of that straight, just the information, I had to create really detailed chronology for Julian, Advika, each ex-wife, so I knew exactly what was happening in their lives at any given time, and also give me a better understanding of their careers, because, again, these are such distinct and different careers, and what impacts them is so different and distinct. So that was the way I kind of, the main way I kind of organized myself in terms of trying to make sure I captured each era and industry as well as I could.
You did a wonderful job. But now tell me about Julian. Is there someone that he is inspired by? Do you have a picture in your head of who Julian is?
I guess, and I say this in the novel, I feel like he has the charm of a Paul Newman, maybe a little lankier than Paul Newman, like maybe the lankiness of Clint Eastwood, but the charm of a George Clooney or a Paul Newman. And I think he has to, because one of the things I think we've learned also in recent years in Hollywood is that charm and good looks will take you a long way in terms of what is forgiven or what is invited over. And I feel like Julian probably did not make a lot of friends, probably made a lot of enemies along the way in terms of his behavior, not just with ex-wives, excuse the voice again, not just with his ex-wives, but just as a power player in Hollywood. And I feel like being charming and handsome is a huge asset for men, especially in Hollywood. I think we see that with certain actors today and what they get away with because they are handsome. So that's what I had in mind when I designed Julian, is the idea that he probably has done some less than good things to a lot of powerful people, but being handsome and charming is a long way to get you either forgiven or just kind of the charm overpowers a lot of any pushback you might receive.
What do you think, drawing on your knowledge as an entertainment reporter as well, what do you think will be the future of the impact of the Me Too movement going forward? Do you think that things will change, or that they've just changed for a week and they're going to go back to the way they always were?
It's hard to say at the moment. I think in some ways things have changed, in the sense that we can have dialogue and conversations now that we weren't having about the treatment of underrepresented people, but especially women, which is important, because I don't think there was any sort of conversation or dialogue or way to contextualize what was happening to certain people when they would be called. I mean, so many women, if I think about it, are called difficult or dismissed as difficult, or no one wants to work with them because they're demanding or whatnot. And now we have a better idea when a woman is labeled difficult, what that could really mean. She's ambitious in a way that other people or men are not comfortable with. And it's just easy to slap the difficult label on them and even maybe blacklist them because they're not fitting into the archetype of what they want a woman in the entertainment industry to be. For example, I was listening to someone discuss the new Barbara Streisand audiobook, or her new biography, and she talked about one of the reasons she wanted to write a book is because people kept putting labels on her to the point where a friend of hers was telling her that someone said that you were really difficult to work with or really mean, because they read that somewhere. And I told them, no, Barbara is really wonderful to work with. And this person wouldn't believe the person who actually met Barbara. They would more likely believe something they heard offhand. And I think that happens a lot to people in the industry, especially women, where if there's a growing consensus or idea of who you are, people will just believe it without pushing back, questioning it. And we're lucky to see some women now, like Barbara Streisand or Britney Spears or Janet Jackson, finally get pushed back on the narratives that have been built around them and shaped them and have really impacted them on their careers. So that's a little positive thing. And a less than positive thing, I think cancel culture is a thing that feels like it's not an actual thing. If you think about who's actually been canceled, after some less than wonderful news has come out about them, it's not really canceled. They're still here. They're still working. In some cases, they're still being nominated for and winning awards. So I'm glad the conversation is happening. It was an important and long overdue conversation. I think it's helping some women get the respect they deserve, long overdue respect. But I think there's, of course, a long ways to go to.
Well, let me ask you the same question about Oscars. So what? The Grammy nominations came out this last week, and there were a lot of women and diverse women in the major categories, which I saw as a positive. But also the fact that I like a lot of the music that they nominated, which is usually I've never heard of most of the music that was nominated. And I know a lot about music. But do you think that the Oscars so white that is that pushed for more diverse nominations, at least, will stick?
I hope so. I feel like it kind of feel like it fluctuates every year. Like some years have better representation than others. In terms of the Grammys, I think what's interesting and maybe a tad concerning about them is that while the nominations are always really diverse, when it comes to actually awarding talents in the big categories, it'll default to the safer choice. So Beyonce should have won 5 times over that by this point for Album of the Year, and she never has. So having her be the most nominated artist in Grammy history is not, what does that mean in the grand scheme of things if she can't win in one of the 4 major categories? And so in that case, we have a long way to go in terms of to honoring what's truly represent, not just, you know, representation, but like who is at the forefront of pop culture. No one is more at the forefront of pop culture than Beyonce. And if you can't reward that justly, then what are we even doing?
Yeah, but of course that raises an interesting question. Like when the you mentioned Beyonce, so naturally I think of the famous moment where Kanye West came up on stage and took Taylor Swift's moment away from her and said it should have been Beyonce, which I think was, you know, it's fine that he feels that way, but it's not so fine that I think it was wrong for him to do what he did. But the people who win also win. I mean, do they not deserve to win? You know, I mean, those are kind of the questions that come up when you start talking about this. Like, you want to be diverse, but on the other hand, you also want to reward the people who are there doing their work, whoever they are.
Well, that's what I mean about saying not just about representation, but that people are actually at the forefront of pop culture. Every year that Beyonce has been nominated for Best Album of the Year or Record of the Year, someone deserving wins. I don't think, you know, you can't say that Adele isn't deserving or maybe Beck isn't deserving, but I don't think you can ever say, if you think about the best of the year, so much of what these awards are about is if we look back 20 years from now and we see who the winners are, which are supposed to represent that year, it should be the person who actually changed pop culture that year. And if you can remember the name of the Beck album, that one album of the year, the same year Beyonce was nominated, then you're have a better memory than me. And I think that's the point I'm trying to make. Like, they're supposed to be signifiers of what was breaking people's minds and changing the culture at that time. And I don't think the winners, not just in the Grammys, but a lot of different awards, always do a good job of representing that.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. And all of those things that we've talked about are all elements in your marvelous novel, Advoca and the Hollywood Wives. Kirthana Ramasetti, and thank you so much for stopping by and talking to us about it on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
A new book from Christopher Reich is always exciting. If you're a fan of well-written, gripping thrillers, then you probably already know his work. He's the author of The Take, Numbered Account, Rules of Deception, Rules of Vengeance, Rules of Betrayal, and about 15 other thrillers. His new book is Matterhorn, and I'm pleased to welcome him right now. Christopher Reich, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, it is a pleasure to be here.
I don't think I said the titles of your book correctly. I don't think it's really, you know, Numbered Account. Or I think it's Numbered Account, Matterhorn.
I think that's how you say it after you read the book. You get that kind of testosterone, that adrenaline flowing. But thank you.
Well, since your new book is a mystery, and I don't want to be the one to give anything away. Tell readers what they would need to know about Matterhorn and your newest creation,
Matt. You know, first of all, I like to say that when I started writing books, I was influenced by really the classics, you know, the masters, Frederick Forsyth, Tom Clancy, Ken Follett, John Grisham. So that's the style of book I write. And so Matterhorn follows right in there, right in the Robert Ludlum genre. It's about a retired spy, Mac Decker, who has gone to hide away high in the Swiss Alps in the small alpine village called Zinal, Z-I-N-A-L. I mean, there's nothing up there. You know, there's like five cows, two shepherds, you know, and a dairy. But he has to be there. He has to get away because if anyone finds out he's still alive, all the people he knows, his family, his friends, will be at risk. Well, that's our setup. And then, sadly, it opens up. He discovers his son, with whom he has had no contact for 8 or 9 years, has perished. How? He has fallen to his death from the top of the Matterhorn, the most iconic mountain, you know, in the world. If there's one mountain that you know what it looks like, it's the Matterhorn. Just look at your Toblerone chocolate bar. So this is the inciting incident, and it forces Mac to leave this comfortable, though isolated existence, to risk everything and all the people he know to find out who killed his son.
And it's very exciting, and there's a lot of characters. I wonder how you keep them all straight. Do you have a wall with strings? How do you do it?
Gary, I got to tell you that in this book, there's really only four or five really main characters, because I have guilty as charged. I sometimes get very wrapped up in my books, and they get to be complicated, and they're longer novels. But I frankly think that a longer novel with really well-developed characters ends up being much more rewarding for all the time you spend, and which is why, you know, I always say life is always better when you're reading a good book. And so I take that to heart when I'm writing my books. So I hope that when they finish these books, and, you know, Matterhorn is really fast and furious compared to some of my other works. You know, it is pedal to the metal from page 25 on. But it's at the end, if you don't shed a tear, if you don't really feel, as my agent says, verklempt at the end, I must have done something wrong.
Well, you did something right, because that's what happened to me. But and it's a fast read. I think it really, like, you can't put it down. And, you know, that's always wonderful when you're reading a book. Then I think the worst part of your books is, you know, you get to the end and then it's over. But there's always another one. You've written so many. How is it that you've written so many books?
Well, you know, I try to write a lot, but I write about a book every 18 months, every 2 years. And, you know, I'm not keeping pace with John Grisham or Brad Thor or Harlan Coben, my contemporaries. Somehow I'm just not able to pour my heart out onto these pages that quickly. I love those books. I just write my books as quickly as I can. But trying to deliver the audience, the reading experience that I just love having. I mean, for me, like I said, you know, every night I sit down, I always end my day reading for 30 or 45 minutes. And, you know, the better the book, I go to sleep, I have better dreams. I just feel good. I wake up, no matter what the day holds, it's like, wow, at the end of the day, I can get back to read something great.
How many hours a day do you spend reading? Do you have like do you have a writing regime, or do you just write when you're inspired?
No. In this business, if you're writing a book a year or a book every 2 years, if you're writing like for your life, it's a job like any other job. I get up, I exercise in the morning. I hit my desk by 8 a.m., Gary. And I try to sit there till 3 or 4, no lunch break, just getting to it, getting through it. You know, it doesn't just flow. It's not like, oh, the muse has landed on my shoulder. Let me tear these pages. It's like you sit there going, oh, my God, what's wrong? I can't figure it out. You know, and often what readers don't know is that all of us will write 20 or 30 pages and say, uh-oh, that doesn't work. And there is nothing harder than like saying, snap, tearing those pages up.
Throwing it away. Wow. And do you always know when you set out to write a novel, do you start with an outline, you know exactly how it's going to end, or do you sometimes find yourself surprised by what's happening with your characters?
First of all, I always know the subject matter. So the inspiration comes with these type of big thrillers, these big, you know, globe spanning, bomb ticking, loyalty blurring thrillers, comes in thinking up the concept. You know, what is this kind of thing about? And then I usually have a really good idea about the first 10 chapters. You know, like in the NFL, when I've been watching all the games, like, we have the first 16 plays all planned. So they put the first 16 plays, and then it all falls apart. They have no idea. So I got the first 16 plays. I think I know the ending, but all hell breaks loose in between. And that's where it's like, Chris, you wrote the first 100 pages in 3 weeks. It's been like 9 months. Where's the rest?
Oh, that's funny. Your books, to me, I have to think of Ian Fleming. I mean, you mentioned all those other great spy novelists. When you were a kid, did you read James Bond?
Everyone by the age of 13. And I mean, I tore through those. I mean, come on. When you talk to me about James Bond, that's even now, age 62. I mean, I'm counting the days till the next James Bond. I know all those books. I know all the titles. I know, could tell you what they're all about. I obviously, they made some kind of very strong impression on me, and personality wise and, you know, writing wise. It's all about the plot. Keep it exciting. Keep it moving.
So obviously you came to writing from, you were a spy. You worked for the State Department. You pretended that you were working as a banker or for a what? But you were really a spy. And I think your books are coded messages. You know, you're still a spy. Am I right?
Boy, life would be so exciting if that were the case. And, you know, it's funny, when I wrote my first book, Gary, Numbered Account, which is all about like murder and mystery in the
numbered account
in Zurich, you know, people came up to me and said, oh my, is it really that way? Is it that scary? And it's like, well, I don't want to disabuse you. I'm glad you enjoy the book, but it really is just a bank. And we do things that might not be exactly the same as Americans do, nevertheless. So, you know, the secret with writing these books, these thrillers, is, you know, you want people to suspend their disbelief. You want to give a lot of truth, a lot of excitement, a lot of factual buildup. So at the end, when things get a little bit crazy, they will follow you there. So I pride myself on the research I do and making my books as realistic as possible. So then at the end, when they do turn into a James Bond book, to Moonraker or Goldfinger, that you're going to say, well, Chris was so honest in the first part, I'm going to follow him here.
I guess that's sure. That's the secret. Make the characters real enough that when they fly through the air, it's believable. There's a lot in your book about Russia and Ukraine and stuff. Do current politics influence your writing when you're working?
I think when you write these books, like over time, year by year, you are always looking for influences, for exciting ideas and stuff like that. So naturally, I mean, there's no more important incident, no more important event going on right now than the war in Ukraine and Russia trying to kind of expand its influence and say, hey, flex its muscles in our absolutely, you know, not, we must without doubt stop them, right? And so, of course, I try to work this into this book. In all my books, I work, and they're all very kind of mirrors of the era in which they take place. My book, The Devil's Banker, I wrote right after 2001, and that has to do with all about how the sophisticated means of financing, you know, terrorist finance, the Hawala Network. And I did a lot. I was at the CIA a lot, counterterrorism a lot in New York, and really learning. It's like, my goodness, how are we trying to stop this? So, you know, with Matterhorn, we're talking about really a devilish scheme to poison a water supply in Ukraine, something which I know from people that work in that industry, in that area, is of great concern, because these these bioweapons exist. I mean, they are there like on the shelf. It's like, you know, they're like going shopping. Which one am I going to pull down to use? So, yes, to answer your question, I do. I am heavily influenced by, you know, current events.
And, you know, we were just talking about all the fiction that you enjoy and Tom Clancy and Robert Ludlum and Ian Fleming. But do you read a lot of history and political
science? These days, I read more, by far, more nonfiction than fiction. For two reasons. First of all, I just love learning new things, and I try to work those into my books. I just have been rereading Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall and everything about Henry VIII. And I bought all these books, The War of the Roses, The Plantagenets. So, you know, I am up to here. Yeah. You know, they could put me on the BBC right now, and I'm ready to go be a talking head about, you know, about the court of Henry VIII. But other times, I mean, I've read all of Stephen Ambrose's books. My next book will be a continuation. Actually, not the next, but the third book in the Mac Decker series will take place in 1941, 1 week before Pearl Harbor, where Mac's grandfather is a young investment banker, and he's charged with going to Switzerland to stop the SS and the Nazis from getting the money they need to launch a nefarious attack, which is all tied in with Pearl Harbor. So I still want to bring back my Swiss banking roots and explore that very interesting chapter in history.
So you're working a few books ahead in your brain as you're working, or it just takes a while for the books to come?
I love historical novels, like, you know, be it Hilary Mantel or any of those old books. I love reading anything about the stuff that takes place in the past. So that's always been in my mind. I wrote one book, my second book, The Runner, which took place right in July of 1945, a period that has rarely been covered, but was so fraught with intrigue, the beginnings of espionage, really the balancing of power between the East and the West. So I wanted to revisit that. Now, my second book in this series, called The Tourists, takes place in Paris. It's Mac Decker survives his first book amazingly, and it's his story going on. So there, yes.
And you have a couple of series. You know, are you done with each series and then you start a new one, or will you revive your older characters?
Well, I had my Jonathan Ransom series, which is the rules books you so kindly mentioned. Thank you, Gary. Sure. More interestingly, is my Simon Risk series. Starting with The Take, Crown Jewel, The Palace, and most recently Once a Thief, which is about to start filming with Netflix UK, directed by Edward Berger, the Academy Award-winning, BAFTA-winning director of All Quiet on the Western Front. So we're about to start shooting that. Very excited about that. I'm very happy that Ed is taking a break from such weighty topics as World War I to really get into some fun escapist fiction. You know, the take is to catch a thief with Jason Bourne thrown in. It is a great main character, Simon Risk, going full, you know, pedal to the metal in London and Paris and Marseille. There's a beautiful woman involved. Yes.
So my question was, will those series continue, or?
Simon Risk will continue. The other ones most probably will not. Just because I have new ideas, new vistas, kind of. And either you stay with the character forever, or you can kind of go and reinvent them. I'm kind of more like Ken Follett, where he has three or four books at a time, then he'll move to the next subject. I just can't keep on writing the same person over and over and over.
Yes, you're not Raymond Chandler or Ian Fleming in that way. But your female characters are really strong. Have you thought of having a female character be the main
character? Absolutely, especially with Matterhorn. Mac's daughter Jane is a agent, unbeknownst to him, also, and she's I'm just, first of all, waiting for our first American president that's female. Please, let's make that happen now. But my goodness, you know, women are just as capable, every bit as capable as men, of undertaking the most difficult covert mission. I remember meeting Valerie Plame, who was involved in the Niger, was it the the scandal where her husband was involved with the red cake or whatever it was called, some kind of cake, uranium-based fissile material. And we got to know each other. You know, she was a bona fide covert agent, and learning about how she worked. And my goodness, this was one capable, attractive, basically brilliant woman. It's like, I would not want to be on the other side working against her because she's going to win.
Well, it's pretty fascinating. What about films? I mean, so you have a film that's being made of your work.
We have it.
Do you keep spy films in your head as well as spy books when you're writing, or and thrillers?
I don't always keep spy films because I don't ever envision like an actor or a person I know being one of my characters. Mm. They exist in my head, and I don't want them to conform to a certain look. You know, they're not Brad Pitt or George Clooney or something like that.
Of course, now that you've seen me.
Or you, Gary, because you're looking very fit, looking good. But I do listen to soundtracks from a lot of those. And the best soundtrack is from The Bourne Supremacy by John Powell, and I'll put that on, and it will make me go, Chris, no wisecracking, no joking, no looks aside. This is all about life or death, you know, from the first word to the last. And that music just instills in me, gives me a chill. It's like, boom, you know, it's like, okay, now I know, you know, the theme I have to follow and come through. Very effective.
Oh, that's interesting. The excitement of a movie score will help you in your writing.
This is not just with me. A lot of writers do this. Some writers play the same song. It could be a Bruce Springsteen song that they like, or whoever. I personally like instrumental music. I like that. I like Beethoven. Beethoven's Emperor gets me going a lot. But I don't do it all. I can't listen for too long, but to get the mood started, you know, start the day. First of all, no phone, chunk, you know, no internet. Just give me, I write longhand.
Oh, on a pad.
Give me that little music in my ears, then stop and flow. It's all about flow. Get the flow going. And then, my goodness, man, that's where the magic happens.
Now, I read about you that you had not studied writing and you'd never even written a short story before you started writing Number to Count. Is that right?
That is correct. I had the idea in my head that, having never taken an English class at Georgetown University, having never, Gary, written one short story or even one page of prose or anything, you know, I was newly married and I didn't like my job. And I said to my wife, you know, I want to leave this. I want to become a writer. And she said, you know, I want to write novels. Do you think you could do this? And I said, you know, I haven't done it, but I sure read a lot and I'm pretty good at writing. And I have a quick, funny story. When I worked at the Union Bank of Switzerland, I worked in the mergers and acquisitions department. When you're an M&A, when you buy or sell a big company, you write these big deal books. They're like 500, 700, 800 pages long of just charts and financial stuff, and they're just dry. I mean, if you need a reason to go to sleep, read 5 of these pages and you're gone. But they looked at me and they said, Reich, they go, you're not any good at finance. You have to write the deal book. So I had to synthesize this, and I did a couple of these, and I get a call from the head of our bank, Nicholas Sen. He goes, Herr Reich, come visit me. And it's like, holy crap. You know, it's like going to see the government. It's usually not going to turn out good, right? So I walk up there, and he has one of these deal memos in his hand, and he puts his arm around my shoulder. He goes, I read your deal memo. He goes, it was very amusing. He goes, you are our own Michael Crichton.
Well, that's really nice.
And I never forgot that. And, you know, to be a writer, you need confidence. And that little, it's like, I never forgot that. No, I didn't start writing for 5 or 6 years after. But even so, when you start alone in that small room and it's dark, you need that voice saying, can you do it or not? Now, I had my wife that was really supportive. And I remember that voice of the head of the biggest Swiss bank, who was like a god in Switzerland. They are treated, I mean, he said, you're our own Michael Crichton. So why not?
Well, did you, when you decided to become a writer and you wrote Number to Count, did you have a bunch of stories banging around in your head that you thought, oh, I've already got the stories, I just need to put them down? Or did the stories come as you started writing?
Yeah, there was, it's a combination, Gary. I did work in the largest Swiss bank. I first started in a private banking department before moving on to mergers and acquisitions. And you do see a lot of very interesting things going on. And I must admit that right from the beginning, I thought, if I ever want to be a writer, I have to put this story into the book. Okay. Now, I wasn't like writing them down, but of course, like all of us, I was cataloging it in my mind. It didn't go away. And then one day when I decided to be a writer, you know, they say write what you know, right? So of course I'm going to write about this one world that very few people have access to. I'm a Swiss citizen. My father, Willy Wolfgang Reich, grew up in Zurich and immigrated to America. It was so funny. Once my dad was in America, he never liked going back to Switzerland. He was such an American. But anyhow, so writing this book is like, okay, I'm going to write about what I saw and maybe, you know, put some steroids here and there and this and that, make it a little bit more exciting. I mean, I grew up, like I said, like you said, reading Ian Fleming, but you know, the kernel of every single anecdote, every single page of Numbered Account is true.
Well, Christopher Wright, the new book is called Matterhorn. Now, it's a great book. It's very exciting. I couldn't put it down. And I'm glad to know there are so many more of your books for me to read. And I'm looking forward to the next one. And maybe you'll come back again and talk to us when that one comes and the one after.
Gary, it was a pleasure. And thank you for having me. Really, I appreciate it.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.